Here we go.
Bucky's Auto Service Centers. Anything your car may need, take it to Bucky's Auto Service Centers. They'll do great work for you. You'll love working with them. You can trust them at Bucky's Auto Service Center. What the heck?
Did you forget where you were?
Just for a moment. Just for a moment, I forgot to jump. Yeah. You got to use your knees. You got to use your knees, Tom.
You walked off the plank without jumping.
Bend my knees. You got to bend your knees. You got to get some height. All right, here we go. Surviving Seattle. This is another story, Seattle Times. How difficult it is to live in Seattle, especially if you're a musician. How musicians cope with the increasing expensive city.
Are you mocking the topic?
Well, yeah, how do you say it? Why do you say that?
Tone.
Tom.
Yes. Do you care?
No.
Okay.
I'll tell you why.
Surprise.
Life is hard as a musician. It's very, very difficult. Yeah. What group can you think of used to have to take toilet water out of a urinal and use it to shave and clean your face with? What group used to take a toilet water out of a urinal because they slept in a toilet? They slept in a bathroom on the hard floor and had only a single, like, flimsy drape to hang to put over them to keep them warm. You know what group that was? They're using water out of a urinal to wash their face.
Said that three times. Oh!
That's right.
It's what made the Beatles the Beatles. The toilet water.
Oh! Yeah. They lived in Germany for 2 years, Tom. And they slept in the club that they worked in. And the only place for them to sleep was a bathroom. And as George Harrison said, every morning we are awoken to the sound of a German woman pissing. Life is hard if you want to be a musician. If you want to make any money. And this story basically says, look how hard it is to live in Seattle, pay the rent, and still be a musician.
Well, it's about how they do it.
I see.
And whether they can keep doing it. Okay. But I think you maybe want to take it to a different level. The Seattle Times article profiles a lot of people who, you know, most of them have to have day jobs, and they also work night jobs, and things are getting, rent is getting so expensive, the number of people are moving farther and farther out, are afraid because of rising rents and all that. So, I mean, we can go into their stories. One guy ended up moving back. We're talking about late 20s and early 30s. One guy moved back to Enumclaw, moved back in with his parents to focus on his music because he wasn't making it here in Seattle.
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, this whether we were in boomtown Seattle like we are right now, or, you know, the bottom of the barrel Seattle when people were turning out the lights because of Boeing and all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always hard to be a musician.
Right.
It's just they're trying to say, okay, now in this kind of, boom time, what's it like? And so they talk about the various strategies. And unlike the Beatles, at least one of the women here has an 8-year-old child that she, is responsible for getting to school and the like. So I'm not sure she could live in a German bathroom for 2 years. But still, I think maybe the bigger issue then, if you want to go into that, is just how does the city cope when it becomes so expensive you can't have your musicians sort of homegrown? Does it matter or not? Because you've got places like New York City and San Francisco that are much more expensive than Seattle, and yet they have thriving cultures. But you're right, it may be that they're moving farther and farther out. Like, I don't know too many musicians that can afford to live in Manhattan, but they live in the outer boroughs, and then they perform in Brooklyn.
The city doesn't owe them anything.
No, they're not. And John, this is not
but
a
But you
kind
just
of,
said that.
Does the city lose something if we can't afford to have homegrown artists? But it's not even a plea for help. It's just an understanding of this. It's tough because I think we can admire, both of us can admire, because we know a lot of people in the arts world, admire people that are willing to, they've given up stable jobs and families and those kinds of things to try to pursue an artistic passion. And it just makes it tough. But you're right. It's been tough since the Middle Ages and before.
I'll tell you, Georgetown 10 years ago. And Georgetown today.
Georgetown here in Seattle.
Right. Georgetown now is a really cool place.
Yes.
10 years ago, nobody wanted to go to Georgetown.
That's
only
right.
a few artists been, did.
Yeah.
But now it has a vibe to it. It's the same story every single place across the United States.
Yeah.
From Austin, Texas to New York City, when the artists and the musicians and dancers and playwrights and stuff lived in one part of the village, and then they just kept being moved further and further out because it became more and more expensive, and people wanted to live in these cool lofts and live next to artists and musicians that were creating a real kind of cool sense of community.
Yeah.
And then they were forced from the Lower East Side, then they were forced down into Alphabet Land, and then from Alphabet Land, they shipped them off into Hoboken, New Jersey, and then all of a sudden Hoboken was cool.
Yes.
Who would ever think Hoboken would be cool?
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, how about Jersey City? Now we can afford Jersey City. So as each place that these artists move, people will follow where the artists are. So you can expect, put this down, write this down, by the way, Andrew. In 5 years, Enumclaw will be the place because that one artist that's living in his parents' basement is sort of the pioneer, Tom, for everybody else
especially
to want to be in Enumclaw.
If you like horses.
Possibly.
So the thing is, you're right, though, but and each of these communities where artists take over, they become gentrified, and then the artists can't afford it. So I've been in town long enough. I remember the Belltown days. It's like 30 years ago. Belltown was like this backwater, and so it was where a lot of artists and a lot of clubs were, and now that is as pricey an area as possible. So I think that's definitely the case. But so I just got a quick question for you, and we can move on to the next topic. But I remember there was a – so I've seen a lot of local theater in Seattle, and what happens is there are actors who I've seen like in 15, 20 plays. They're always the leads and all these various things. And I remember a letter that one of these actors wrote to Seattle after spending – something like 15 or 20 years in Seattle on all the major stages in all the major roles. He was moving to Louisville, Kentucky, because now Louisville, unbeknownst to maybe a lot of people, have this a thriving arts community there. And he talked about that at the most money he ever made as an actor, I think his name was Larry Ballard, if that's correct. Anyway, it was something like $38,000.
Wow.
And it was just like, that's amazing that these guys at all, you know, the people that patrons of the arts tend to be, you know, more well-to-do than not.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that everybody in that audience watching him and applauding him playing King Lear or whomever are making twice to 10 times more than he's making, I do feel like there's no way to gauge how they should get paid or get paid more. But if that was really the case, it really brought me up short.
Yeah.
They're people that we admire, but because of the field they're in, they don't make, I mean, they make a pittance.
I lived in New York City, and I remember this waitress that I used to work with. She was, most of the people were actors. It was at the Grand Hyatt. And she came in one day and said, guess what? I'm taking over the lead in Evita. And we were like, oh, my God, you made it.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Catherine's made it. Oh, my God, Catherine. Evita. Because I forget who the first star was that started Evita.
Oh, yeah.
The name will come to you in the 80s. Yeah, it will come to you. Okay. So we're like, well, kiss her goodbye, everybody. Say goodbye to Catherine. Bye, Catherine. She's off to great things.
Yeah. And?
5 months later, she was back.
Because she got fired?
No. She just, I guess they went with somebody else, whatever. But she didn't have enough money. My friend Lewis Hobson, who's been, you've seen him in probably 500 plays at the Fifth Avenue.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know Lewis Hobson.
Okay. Yes.
Great actor.
He knows, he's fantastic.
Singer, dancer,
yes.
Just all around really, really great human being, right? He left Seattle to move to New York and did some plays in New York. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back again because you make absolutely no money in theater. Zero money in theater. So Lewis Hobson and other great actors that struggle just to put, you know, two nickels together. But they do it for their art and they realize, hey, I'll never be rich. But I have an incredibly fulfilling life because I love my job. My job is something that makes me want to go in every day. In fact, that brings up the little cut. This is from the Wall Street Journal. What is a good job? And this is the CEO of, how do you say the name of this yogurt thing? Gubani? Gubani yogurt.
Shobani, right?
Is it Shobani? Kabani? Gubani? Yeah, here we go. Ready?
Good job for me is you come from your home, but it's the safest place to work, that you don't have to pretend. You come on your own natural way, natural being, on your natural stage.
Okay, he's lost me. No, I'm not kidding. I'm kidding. Here you go.
And you come to work and you contribute your God-given talent to a place you passionately believe in and surrounded by support group and leaders and colleagues that you trust. And you go back home maybe physically tired but emotionally charged to work.
And that is a good job.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely true. That's the way we all want to feel when we leave our 8 hours or 6 hours or 18 hours, that we really feel like, you know, we're tired, but we've we've done our sort of expended our talents, you know, for the good of the world. The problem is that that is how you might feel, and that makes it a good job for you. I don't know if that makes it a good job for, say, your boss or the company or for society. But if we can all feel that way and have the job be contributing to the betterment of society, that's the perfect world. But that's a very sort of a self-referential kind of idea of what a good job
is. There's a second part to the relationship, which is to say, I feel really good about myself. And the boss goes, yeah, but you sort of suck. Yeah, but I feel really good about myself.
Or we just don't value it. John, you're really good on the air, but we're going to give you about $4 an hour because, you know, a lot of people want your job. And so why pay more for that?
Right.
Well, wait a minute. You know, so you have to find that happy medium. But it's true. That's the idea of a good job for you as the employee.
You can have a job like Tim Iman. I think he sells trinkets or watches or something or other, but he has enough money to loan himself his own money for the latest initiative, which involves cutting car tab taxes and pledges 400,000 more. Iman hopes to repay those supporters' donation. It's a strategy he has used before.
So he tried to do this a couple of years ago without using his own money, and it failed. I don't know if people were surprised at that or not. I remember, you know, for a while there, Tim Iman was the hottest thing going, and his signatures were falling in his lap by the truckloads. The last one, they didn't get enough signatures for this, and he couldn't understand it because he's convinced that people, if they had a chance, half a chance, would be in favor of this. So he says, you know what? I'm going to put my money where my mouth is this time out. Mm-hmm. I'm going to spend my own $100,000 and whatever else he can raise to pay, you know, get paid signatures, paid signature gatherers. That he's convinced that you just need to, if you can pay for the gatherers, you'll be able to get the signatures.
Right.
And so he's trying it. He's also offered to put up $400,000. I think, I'm assuming that's to get it once it's on the ballot. If not, I mean, he certainly should be able to pay for, he's going to spend $1 million. I'd hope he'd get enough signatures. But
give
anyway,
him credit. 2008, Iman took a second mortgage on his home for $150,000 to his initiative to open HOV lanes to all traffic. The measure lost at the ballot.
Well, I know. In fact, the last two that he did, I think, he mortgaged
$250,000 in 2015 as an initiative to limit taxes money. It was eventually paid back. The initiative was thrown out by the Supreme Court. You got to give the guy credit. He's willing to put his money where his mouth is. And this is his own money. This isn't someone like Ferguson taking your money and fighting people. This is Iman taking his own money. He says, please help me back our $30 car tab and stick it to Sound Transit.
Now.
And show Bobby Ferguson, his attacks have only inspired us to work even harder. Go, Tim Iman, go.
That's right. Just because it's illegal doesn't mean it's not worth fighting for.
What's illegal?
The thing about the things that he's gotten past, they're shown to be unconstitutional.
Some.
So, some. So what he's doing is he's putting his money where his mouth is, and I think you're right, unless you're his wife. I don't know. You're mortgaging the house a second time and a third time, but... And just to keep this in mind, he is not thinking of this as a charity. He's just not donating this money. He thinks that he will repay himself when people start donating to the cause. And that's where it's gotten kind of tricky how he can legitimately do this. Because the reason he's so mad at Bob Ferguson is that Bob Ferguson is suing him for paying himself. He raised, I don't know if it's like $2 million or something, that he took himself because the measure didn't make it to the ballot, and he used that money for himself.
Yeah.
And so the state says, you can't run a campaign for your own personal financial benefit. And so that's why he's particularly mad at Ferguson. We'll have to see if this payment gets him on the ballot.
Well, people making money off of politics is nothing new. The fact that the president's fixer, Michael Cohen, an attorney from New York, and I use the term, people are saying, was he really ever an attorney? He has set up an interesting position for himself. There's a corporation, I forget the name of it, and that's where they funnel the money through.
Essential Consultants LLC.
Right, and were they out of, I think they said set up out of Delaware, I'm assuming, right? So they set up this LLC, and then they move money through the corporation in order to be able to not exactly be transparent as to where the money's going and who's paying for the money. So Cohen sets this thing up, but then after the president, he doesn't get a job in the administration, but then realizes, hey, I still have something very powerful, which is the president's ear. So if you'd like to get to the president's ear, you got to put something in my hand.
Yes, to the tune of you know, $1 million from one company and $1 million from the next. AT&T mm-hmm. has admitted they put money into this shell company. And it was, they say, and this was not any quid pro quo.
Yeah.
But that's the concern, and that's why people are looking at it. Right now, they have not established that any of this is illegal, but it does look, if nothing else, swampy,
yeah.
To use Trump's concern or term, that in this company, that's where the payments to Stormy Daniels were kept. But they've also attached a lot of money from a Russian oligarch. And so the question is, did this come out, did this spin out of the Mueller investigation,
uh-huh.
this Russian oligarch, was he indeed swapping favors, buying favors? AT&T, there are a lot of major companies putting money into this all on the sly
mm-hmm.
to influence, to gain access to the president through the his handler. And that's, you know, that's raising some ethical questions about whether there was any kind of give and take.
Mm-hmm.
Now, AT&T has already fessed up. Now they got caught. They said, yeah, we did that. But all we did was we just wanted to have access to the president that Michael
so,
Cohen
so
said.
So it's not illegal.
It was not. Well, we don't know that because if it's illegal, one of the problems, the concerns is it could be illegal if, you know, AT&T is working on this huge merger
uh-huh.
that they want the White House and Congress to approve. And so this could be seen as sort of like paying to play, in effect.
Uh-huh.
And if those a lot of these companies had legislation up in front of the White House and in front of Congress, and if they were paying that to get that to happen, that's considered illegal.
Well, what's the difference between that and paying a lobbyist?
Well, there are all these rules about how lobbyists are. You have
right.
to report. You have
yep.
to declare yourself a lobbyist.
Where it's coming
and
from.
And one of the things that Michael Cohen has done, if they say some of these things turn out to be true, he was, in effect, a foreign agent. I mean, he was dealing with a foreign company, and he didn't. You have to sign up to do all that. If it's all transparent,
mm-hmm.
it's legitimate. But if it's not, that's where it gets untoward and possibly illegal.
He should have set up a foundation and taken foreign money that way.
Well, yeah, if it's all in the up and up,
right, like
that's
the Clintons.
Fine.
All right, fast break, come back, talk about the fact that the scientist that we talked about last week, he was 104 years old, and he wanted to take a trip to Switzerland.
From Australia.
He wanted to go from Australia to Switzerland, and it would probably be his last trip. And then he went to the zoo. You're thinking, well, why is this interesting? Because what he did next, that's the topic of conversation. Right back. That's right, Muckleshoot Bingo, bringing you the know-it-all quiz. The most exciting part of your entire week is on Friday at 11:32. That's when it all happens for you. There's a reason you feel that feeling that you feel at 11:32 on Fridays, because you get a chance to hear the know-it-all quiz or maybe even be a contestant in the know-it-all quiz brought to you by Muckleshoot Bingo. One lucky person is going to win two tickets for the May 18th performance of Aida Tom, showcasing Verdi's power to translate human emotion into magnificent music.
Oh, I've seen it. It's a hell of a production.
Still in the middle of the read, Tom. Find tickets today at seattleopera.org.
I'm sure they won't mind.
Okay. Did you see this show?
It really is spectacular.
This version.
Yes, this version. Yeah, I saw it last Saturday.
Aha.
It's spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Free Ticket coming down. I wonder if you'd feel differently about a show if you paid for it.
Well, the thing is that I pay for things all the time. I mean, I have an aesthetic judgment. I think the fact that I don't pay for it in this particular case doesn't affect it one way or the other. I think I would be forced to like things more.
Ah, he with free seats is first to hiss.
Oh, see, I don't know why that would be, but he might be. You know, you feel like, well, I got no skin in the game, so if I don't like something, I don't have to like it.
But you pay for something, you do have a sort of standard. All of a sudden, because, you know, oh, it's free stuff, like the free stuff they stick out here on the table. You don't necessarily care.
Yeah.
If you pay for something.
No,
I saw Humans at the Seattle Rep, paid big money for
yes.
that. What a piece of crap that show was.
Yeah, it only won the Tony for best play, John.
Oh, my God, was
I think
that
it's
horrible.
No, it's an excellent play, and I did see the same production.
Okay.
And you're blinded.
Okay, yeah, well, you too. When it comes to your life, it is your life, and you can live it as you see fit as long as you're not hurting somebody else. But when you get to a point in your life where you're like, I've had enough of it, and I'd like it to come to an end, should you legally be able to end your life? Now, a man who's 104 years old, he made the news about 2 weeks ago because he said, mm-hmm. you know what, I'm 104, I've reached a place in my life that I'm I don't want to live anymore. Australia won't let me kill myself legally, so I'm going to go to Switzerland, as about 1,000 from the UK go every single year. And people fly in, and they go to this place called, it's got a weird sounding name, it begins with a D?
Well, Life Circle is the...
There's another one.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's another place that'll legally kill you. It's another business place.
Well, not Davos.
No, not Davos. No, no. And so this guy, David Goodall, made the news that he was planning on flying there, and he did. And
it's in Basel.
Caught up with David Goodall, a 104-year-old Australian man, a scientist. Yeah. And you point out, Tom, that up until the age of 100 and some, he was still going to work?
He was still, in fact, at the age of 102, so only a couple of years ago, he had to kind of advocate to be allowed to come onto campus to continue his work. I don't know what the consequence was, but in other words, he was a very active 100, plus year old. So at the age of 104, this is a guy who has no terminal illness, which would have made it easier in more countries for him to put an end to his life.
Yeah.
The fact that he was not within 6 months of terminal illness, I'm not going to take his life within 6 months. He seemed in sound mind and body. He said he was having, in the last couple of years, it was harder for him to get around, that he wasn't seeing as well, wasn't hearing as well, which are traditionally the kinds of things that elderly people have to deal with. But other than that, it wasn't that he was doing it out of depression. He just said enough was enough.
He sat down with an interview and described why he wanted his life to come to an end, and he said,
"Life has become less worth living."
You're hearing that? It's an Australian accent through a 104-year-old mouth. Life is becoming less worth living.
Enjoying life now, as I would have done five or 10 years ago. And I think the same may be true of most people of this age. I get up in the morning, I find a bit of breakfast, and then, generally speaking, I just sit. What's the use of that?
So he gets up in the morning, he does a little bit of work, and then he just sits. And what's the use of that?
The question, I guess, that we all have is, does someone who wants to end his life, is there something wrong with him? Or does it make sense that after a certain time, if you want to kill yourself, that maybe that should be your choice?
Yeah.
A lot of people in Switzerland are unhappy with the fact that they are now seen as the final destination city and or country. There's a lot of pushback against this law. This has been a decades-old law of assisted suicide in Switzerland, but it's not universally acclaimed, and there's a lot of pushback on it. But I think, we're talking to people in the newsroom, too. A guy who lives 104 years old, had a very full and active life, and just decides, okay, I'm done. I think it's hard to have moral objections, I think, to this. I suppose for religious reasons, if you feel like,
life
God
has
given you, that you have no right to do this. But otherwise, it just feels like, wow. I mean, I'm sad that he wanted to do this, but, it's his life, and he certainly lived more of it than most of us get.
He says he's sad that he had to leave his country to do it.
I feel resentful. Resentful of the government and establishment in Australia, that they don't recognize that one would like to end one's days in Australia, as I would.
What's the difference between someone doing that and somebody smoking?
Well, I assume that people who smoke do it for the pleasure of the smoking and not for the end result. Because there are a lot more efficient ways.
But aren't they, in effect, killing themselves?
Yes.
Okay.
But, the idea is, it's sort of the end point.
Uh-huh.
If I end up dying, if I'm a pilot and I love to fly and I die flying, it's not like I didn't love it because there was the threat of death or I thought I might die or was going to die. I'm doing it because I enjoy the procedure. It's because it's so specific.
I think the difference for this guy is he's had a great life.
Yeah.
He's loved it. I think he still loves life. I think he sees the difference between his heart or his soul, his energy, and his body, that his body has failed to allow him to continue to enjoy life to the level that he wants to enjoy it.
Yeah.
It's not out of some dark depression.
No,
it's where he can't imagine the next day. He just said, I don't like sitting. He is trapped by his body so that he wants to leave his body.
Yes, although just even there, hearing him, he seems so full of life and opinions and all. But I think the deal is most people do not live to be 104. I think again, except for the religious notion, I think if most people can live to 104, I think most people would be fine with, okay, you want to end it at 104?
Doesn't seem arbitrary at all. 104.
Well, you make it over 100. How about that? Yeah. Hit the century mark. You're on your own, buddy. You can do whatever you want. You don't have to fly to Switzerland.
You can punch out. Is suicide a... Is it a rational or irrational decision? I've seen that study where people that have survived jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, they say the first thing that went through their head before it was their knees was the fact that regret.
I know.
That they said they left the edge of the bridge and they hit the water. These are the 100 people that have survived. And they said all the way down, all they were thinking about was, oh, no.
Wow. See, to me, that's my concern, because I would fight against... this in most cases, because I do think that wanting to kill yourself is a temporary want, that it passes. In fact, there have been studies where if you can, that's why talking to somebody on a bridge, for instance, is really valuable. If you can get through, people get through like a 15-minute period where everything seems to be coming to a head to get them to kill themselves, that delay in itself is what gets them over it, and most of them are happy. Now, it is true that people have tried to commit suicide, or you know, attempted suicide a number of times, and they still do, and maybe they will never get out of it. But I always think that's how you feel right now. But how are you going to feel a year from now or 5 years from now? Your life may be completely different.
Yeah.
And so, is it temporary irrationality, or is it like the justification of everything that your life has culminated in at that moment? Yes, but there's a second moment and a third moment that might not be the same culmination.
I remember reading about a great American artist, Franz Kline, who wanted to kill himself. And he used to walk out of the house and go up the hill to a tree, and he was going to hang himself. His daughter would see her father heading to the tree and run out there, "Dad, can you push me in the swing?" Knowing that was in
it. Brilliant.
I know, and I told a friend of mine about that. He's like, "You should find the daughter."
Oh, yeah.
She was, and then eventually he did succeed and he killed himself.
Is that right?
But she would run out.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that intersection of those two lives. We'll come right back to the Tom and Curly Show right here on Cairo Radio. Write to us at MyNorthWest.com. Text as well at 98973. South Korea, Tom. We follow the lead of South Korea's cracking down on walking and texting. It's developing a program that locks a person's device, after detecting that they have been walking for more than 5 steps while using their phone.
This is ridiculous.
No, it is not. Way to go, South Korea.
You're at one with Moon, huh? Why? So... This is a solution to a problem that isn't worthy of saluting.
Some people are walking into poles, walking into each other, spilling hot drinks, and or maybe just drinks that stain, and walking into traffic, or onto train tracks, or onto runways of airplanes.
You know what I thought this is? Here's a better idea.
Uh-huh.
I think your phone should lock if you haven't walked like a mile a day.
Oh.
How's that?
So look at you. Look at you who wouldn't walk a mile a day for $300
exactly.
a month.
But if I had it took me to open my phone, I would do it.
Uh-huh.
I just said when I saw the headline, it locks phones if user walks around, I thought, what does that mean? I think it's hilarious that they say that smartphone-related traffic accidents doubled over the past 5 years.
See?
Doubled, as you pointed out many times. What's that mean? 2 to 4 doesn't mean a lot.
Hey, those are two additional people that lost their life or were injured.
Well, no, not lost their life. I don't think these are fatalities. It just feels like it's such a minor inconvenience. Now, maybe South Korea they run into society in a very strict fashion that really stands out.
You know, I'm not for this.
No, you've been advocating for this.
No, I have not.
Ever since
I'm advocating. I don't mind you picking up. Yeah. I don't mind you looking at your phone, Amazombies. Just pick up the pace a little bit. That's all. And don't look at me like I'm destroying the planet because I'm sitting in a car while you're lollygagging.
Yes.
And very little ambulating going across the street.
But see, now they couldn't open their phones, and so they wouldn't walk around. And so you should like that. But by the way, they're no longer called Amazombies.
Mm-hmm.
At least in South Korea, they're called Smombies.
Oh.
Because it's smartphone and zombies. That's the new word. And I think it's ridiculous that this is something that's needed. Now, I may be proven wrong if it turns out that by doubling, there were 7,000 traffic-related incidents and all this, but it just feels like, really, that's a problem, that people are taking more than five steps with their phone and therefore, you know.
Well, this is an example of a bunch of officials that have been elected in their position of power, and the problem comes before them, and then they kick it around to finally, hey, I have an idea. How about this? How about the phone locks if you start to move? On Waze, W-A-Z-E, which is the app that I use all the time for directions, it immediately detects if you're moving, even walking.
Yeah.
Because you clunk on it, you open it up, and you want to go somewhere, it'll immediately go, uh-oh, passenger? I mean, are you the passenger or driver? Then you have to click, I'm the passenger, right?
Lying. I mean, you can lie, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you've known because you tested it?
No, I do it all the time. Because it doesn't want to be part of the problem. So it makes you indemnify them by going, oh, no. I am looking at these directions and I am the passenger.
But see, I have no problem with that because there are traffic-related fatalities involved because of people texting and driving. I've been convinced of. Texting and walking, I'm less convinced of it. I'm open to it, though.
On my phone, on this iPhone, that you can put in there that while you're driving, it doesn't receive any calls. You're self-controlling, right? So it's, I don't have the self-control thing beeps, I want to look at my phone, so I'm going to override my own lack of control, and I'll put the phone in charge.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Smart move. Keeps everybody safe.
By the way, in case you're wondering, who are the people that get dinged by this the most? Teenagers returning home from school with smartphones.
See?
The bane of John's existence.
What? It's the teenagers with their vaping
and their
video gaming and their whatever else they're doing. These kids today with their rock and roll music. It just sounds like noise to me. All right, come back. We'll talk about Washington ranks against other states when it comes to talkativeness. Talkativeness and politeness. I wonder where we are on both of those. Plus, also, would you go see an OBGYN? It's named Dr. Dre.
That's a good one.